Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the world of shows like CSI and Law & Order, fingerprints, blood, bullet lead, you name it, it always leads to the bad guy. But real-life forensics aren't so simple. A landmark report released yesterday from the National Academy of Sciences questions decades of crime lab science. What we've relied on for years is often not based on science at all, the report says. It's time to regulate America's crime labs. This hour On Point, crime lab science and the future of forensics. You can join the conversation. Have you ever wondered about the validity of forensic evidence, how it's used in court, whether the smoking gun is really the right smoking gun? Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Harry Edwards. He's Senior Circuit Judge and Chief Judge Emeritus of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. He's co-chair of the National Academy of Sciences Committee, which yesterday released the new Crime Lab report entitled Strengthening Forensic Science in the United States, A Path Forward. Judge Harry Edwards, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Jane. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you. In this report, you call for sweeping changes to the forensics crime lab system in this country. What were the most important recommendations?
The most important recommendations are in two large categories. One involves the need for better research, that is, to examine the limits of the forensic disciplines. In most of the disciplines, save for nuclear DNA, the research is simply not there to provide the scientific basis for the disciplines. It's modest at best, and there's been a call for it by a number of very prominent forensic scientists themselves, in addition to others. The other set of concerns has to do with practice in the forensic science community. Mm-hmm. That is the absence of mandatory certification of practitioners, the absence of mandatory accreditation programs, the lack of consistent protocols and standards in the operations of labs and the like. So there are two big categories. The research will take time, but we think in the interim, if you can get some of these practice procedures in better order, that will help to alleviate some of the problems. And the main recommendation of the report is that there should be a new federal entity independent of any law enforcement enterprise to oversee the work of the forensic science community.
Yes, the National Institute for Forensic Science. What would be the purpose of such an organization?
Well, to be able to encourage the kind of multidisciplinary work that is needed to help to lift the forensic science disciplines from their kind of provincial existence into the multidisciplinary area so that we can get the kind of research that we need and we can get the kind of enforceable standards that we need. We don't have the enforceable standards. It's a very fragmented community right now. And one of the reasons Congress passed the bill asking the National Academy of Sciences to set up a committee to investigate the community, and this has taken us over 2 years to do it, is because they understood, apart from DNA, we don't know much about what goes on in the forensic science community and how good the various disciplines are. So we really need, the committee decided, and it's a strong recommendation, decided that you really needed a federal presence that was strong, you needed federal financial support, and you needed oversight. That is, a single group that would assist in the establishment of standards that would bind the community across the country.
I know that there are many who say that this report should not be a condemnation of past practices. But I'm curious, as a judge, do you wonder how many innocent people are put behind bars because faulty forensic evidence didn't tell the whole truth in some cases?
Well, as a good citizen, I wonder how many innocent people have been put behind bars for any of a number of reasons. The possibility of faulty forensic sciences is merely one among many. Eyewitness testimony is something that has been discussed over the years by scholars as a matter of some concern. So that's always a concern for a judge. We never hope to see an innocent person convicted. But there are clearly issues. I want to make it very clear that the report does not in any way mean to assess past cases, existing cases, or to suggest what might happen with respect to future cases. There are established rules of law and rules of evidence that will continue to govern the admissibility of evidence in the courts. And the question whether evidence in an individual case is admissible is not coterminous with the question as to whether or not any particular discipline is founded on valid and reliable scientific principles. Those are two different questions.
Where will the money, Judge, come from for this system overhaul, if you will?
Well, the federal entity gets established. It will come from the federal government. It does not have to be a huge undertaking initially. We're very aware of the economic climate in which we presently live, and we simply can't throw billions of dollars at yet another project. But there is a lot already there to be used. That's the good thing about this. There are standards that people have attempted to promulgate. They're simply not enforceable, and a lot of times people are not even aware of them. There are notions about accreditation that are there. There are organizations that are there. And if you have a federal entity, a good one with good people in it, they will be able to pull these disparate parts into one whole and give direction to the community at large. And we'll be able to see crime labs across the country operating pursuant to common standards and procedures. And that'll be a very good thing.
Judge Harry Edwards joining us from Washington, D.C., co-chair of the National Academy of Sciences panel that put out this new report, Strengthening Forensic Science in the United States. Judge, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Joining me now in the studio is James Doyle. He's director of the Center for Modern Forensic Practice at John Jay College for Criminal Justice in New York City. He's a veteran litigator now at the Boston firm Carney & Basil and author of True Witness, Cops, Courts, Science, and the Battle Against Misidentification. Nice to have you with us, James.
Hello, Jane. Nice to be here.
And with me also from Denver, Colorado, is Barry Fisher. He's worked in the field of criminalistics with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Crime Lab since 1969 and has served as a crime laboratory director since 1987. He's the past president of the American Academy of Forensic Science and the American Academy of Crime Laboratory Directors. He's author of the widely used textbook, Techniques of Crime Scene Investigation. Barry, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
James Doyle, let me begin with you. You've worked as a litigator. You encounter forensic evidence in court all the time. What's your take on this new report?
Well, the committee in its subtitle promises a path forward, and I think they've been as good as their word. They do take account of the kind of odd history of forensic science and the way it's grown up by fits and starts and scattered places at scattered times and has grown up almost without an infrastructure. It's as though one day lots of people with good technical minds and high levels of intelligence went to the airport and started flying airplanes without an FAA or National Transportation Safety Board. And so one way to look at this report is laying out a kind of infrastructure stimulus package idea for what you would do in the area of forensic science to create the kind of scientific foundation that would allow people to do science. And the hope, I think, would be that science will then discipline itself the way it always does, and we'll get better forensic science and better career paths and lives for forensic scientists. Mm.
Barry Fisher, you've worked in forensics for many years. You've been calling for change to the system, I know. What did you see that made you believe that we needed reform in this country in this area?
Well, first of all, I think this report is wonderful, really, because it focuses so many issues that we've talked about over the years. It was the forensic science community that lobbied Congress to pass legislation to establish this National Academies Committee to look into this, because we had tried for many, many years to get people to recognize what many of the shortcomings of the field were. In many ways, they have to do with lack of funding at the state and local level. Not that anybody expects the federal government to be paying these things, but certainly the judge's comments about the federal government taking a leadership role is critically important, because right now it's a whole bunch of labs. There are about 350 crime labs around the United States, give or take, and also a large number of medical examiner and coroner's offices. I don't have that number. And while there are a number of standards in place that are generally accepted practices, there is no real guidance or oversight to suggest which is the best way to go. And what we hope to do is to address some of the criticisms that we have. I don't believe that forensic science, as some like to call it, is junk science. I think that in some areas, perhaps, the conclusions of expert witnesses is overstated, but I really believe that many of the things that we do have probative value in determining what happened in a particular case.
Barry Fisher, let me put you on hold there for a minute. I have to take a first break here. Barry Fisher is with us from Denver, Colorado. James Doyle is in the studio with us. We're talking about this National Academy of Science new report on forensics. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the state of American forensics and a big new report out yesterday calling into question crime lab evidence. In the studio with me is James Doyle. He's director of the Center for Modern Forensic Practice at John Jay College for Criminal Justice in New York City. Also with us is Barry Fisher. He's longtime director of the Los Angeles County Crime Lab. We talked about what we see on TV and how it defines sort of our vision of what forensics really is. Here's an episode of CSI New York where a girl goes missing and a letter she sent to her father turns up. Investigators match DNA on the back of a stamp to a club owner. And here in this scene, they go to the club to question him to see if he remembers that girl.
17-year-old girls. Willie, she was in your nightclub.
I'm supposed to know her. You know how many women I see coming out my place of business in a day?
Okay, let me be more specific. How many stamps do you lick a week?
You're as tough as you are beautiful.
You put a stamp on an envelope of a letter this young girl wrote to her father in the Ukraine. It's DNA, Willie. It doesn't lie.
Well, I ain't lying either. I don't remember her face.
Barry Fisher, take us into the world of forensics, if you would. What various techniques are out there? And with the advent of DNA, how have things changed over the recent years?
Well, forensic science is applied science. We borrow heavily from chemistry, from biochemistry, biology, medicine, engineering, physics. You can pretty much attach anything. You can pretty much attach the adjective forensic to just about any discipline. It means that it's being used in courts to try to give juries and judges an idea of what's happening in areas that they don't have much understanding about. Now, there have been a couple of major changes in the last 10 or 15 years. One big change is the advent of DNA technology for use in forensic cases.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Prior to that, we had a host of other types of testing involving enzymes and proteins, but we could never quite get down to the levels of certainty that we can get right now. It's not uncommon to have statistics coming out of a DNA case involving one in hundreds of millions of individuals. So that's been a major paradigm shift. The other big shift is the way the courts look at scientific evidence. For many years, since 1923, the United States Supreme Court had a standard called Frye,
mm-hmm.
which was a general acceptance theory. In other words, if people agree that this was reliable practice, it was okay to be admitted into court. The judge, of course, is always considered the gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
A little over 10 years ago, the Daubert decision came down from the United States Supreme Court, which was not a criminal decision. It was a product liability. But the courts began to wrestle with how they interpret evidence. And one of the big features was that they wanted a showing of reliability. Can you really say these things that you claim to be able to do. Now, in areas that involve the traditional sciences, chemistry and biology, say DNA, these issues were had long been addressed in other fields. Other areas such as firearms examination, handwriting, bite marks, shoe prints, fingerprints and such were exclusively within the purview of crime labs. There weren't a lot of other areas involved in this. So because courts had been accepting this stuff for so long, these kinds of questions that we've recently been seeing have never been addressed. And
so, James Doyle, the report says that with the exception of nuclear DNA analysis, that no forensic method has been rigorously able to show consistent with a high degree of certainty and demonstrate a connection between evidence and specific individuals or sources. So how did our system of criminal justice become so reliant on these forensic on forensic evidence itself?
Well, one of the reasons that DNA marked a watershed was that it came onto the scene with clinical uses applied. And so it came into the legal system with much of the preparation that you would have bringing a new drug to market. There was a very serious amount of basic research done. There was very careful work done on population groups, on random match probabilities, on rates of error. Those sorts of things typically did not happen in the more traditional forensic sciences because those sciences or techniques, disciplines, were all developed without a clinical purpose but for the sole purpose, really, of solving crimes. And so that's, I think, what the committee is trying to accomplish here, to create an infrastructure that would permit those disciplines to be evaluated with something like the rigor that DNA was evaluated with before it came to court. The other impact of DNA, of course, is it has, with a number of exoneration cases, shown that there have been cases where the traditional forensic sciences have been implicated in convictions, whether because the science was bad or because the lawyers in the courtroom were misstating it or because the jurors were in awe of it or for some other reason. But the important thing is the contrast between the way science would come to market in an FDA kind of approval process and the way ballistics bite marks and things like that would come to court now. The kind of work that's done in the first process hasn't been done in the traditional forensic sciences.
Is there a range in the quality of labs across this country? I mean, there must be. The fingerprints, the ballistics, the blood spatter. I mean, is it treated differently in different labs across this country, Jim Doyle?
There's a range of practitioners. There's a range of labs. There's a range of resources. There's a range of backlogs. There's a very spotty series of inspections at the end of the process. There's very uneven courtroom testing of the process. There's very uneven training. There's a very uneven feedback loop. There are places that do very good jobs within the limits of the basic science. There are other places that are unreliable. And the difficulty is there's no mechanism in existence now that reliably tells one from the other.
Are you optimistic with this report that there might soon be?
I think that this report is as big a step forward as anybody could take at this point. A lot will depend on the reaction to it. One of the things that this report manages to focus on is that this isn't really just a question of convicting the innocent. The report keeps in mind the fact that every time you grab the wrong guy, the right guy is still out there. And so everyone, whether on the law enforcement side of this conversation or the defense side of the conversation or the civil liberty side of the conversation, has an interest in improving forensic science. And if science is allowed to take its course, which this report seems to give you the raw materials to do, I think you could be reasonably optimistic. I don't think this report is likely to be attacked on substance. Whether there are turf wars or political wars that collect around it, that'll have a lot to say about the outcome.
Let's bring some callers into this conversation. Marcia is in Paso Robles, California. Hi, Marcia. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I just wanted to make the point that the report reflects that science is doing its job. It's reflecting on its own work, the quality of what it's done so far, and making an opportunity to improve. I think we should applaud this effort.
All right, Marcia, thank you. Barry Fisher, let me go back to you, this point that Jim was making earlier about the innocents and those who are guilty and balancing the system. What about innocent people who've been put behind bars over the years? How or will this report, these changes, how will that affect that?
Well, just to start off, and I agree with the statement that nobody wants to see the wrong person convicted and the right person be allowed to go scot-free. So it's just a matter of public policy and common sense that we fix any of these areas that need fixing. I think the report is a marvelous first step towards that. The next step, of course, is going to be in the hands of Congress to move this into some sort of legislative package. The report by itself will have some impact around the country as people look at it and consider it, but the real impact is going to be once Congress takes this and moves it forward in some sort of comprehensive legislation that puts in place mechanisms to deal with these various issues that are raised.
Here's a call now from New London, Connecticut. Markel is on the line. Hi, Markel. Thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm calling to find out, how can one disprove a murder case here in New London, Connecticut that happened about a year ago, in a situation where the prosecutor insists that the forensic evidence is indisputable, and my family disagrees with the forensic evidence, and we believe that the evidence was botched by the medical examiner up in Hartford.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Markel, thank you. Jim Doyle, do you want to tackle that? What do you do if you're a family, you think there's faulty evidence? Where do you start?
Well, it will vary a lot from case to case and place to place. I know that, for example, Connecticut has a very active chapter of the Innocence Project, which I would encourage the caller to get in touch with. They'll be able to tell you something about how you would go about getting a lawyer, what that lawyer would look for in terms of the kind of evidence that you would need, what to look for in the record in terms of the handling of the forensic material. And, of course, from case to case, the different kind of forensic material will vary. Some cases it will be bite marks. Some cases it will be DNA. That presents kind of a spectrum of reliability. So, but the Innocence Project has been very effective in putting good satellite organizations together through an Innocence Network, and that would be the place to go.
Here's another call from Boston. Pierre is on the line. Hi, Pierre. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'd like to ask what role race has played in pushing forward this forensic science, because it seems so many of the people that the Innocence Project has exonerated are black males, and I'm wondering if, to some degree, science has been used to push for the convictions of people. It doesn't matter whether they're innocent or guilty, just to justify an excuse to put them in jail.
Barry Fisher, I'll let you tackle that. Pierre, thanks for the call. The racial component, how does that play into the system?
I don't think that the science really takes into account an individual's race. The sad fact is that the prisons in the United States have a disproportionate number of minorities incarcerated, and it's a bigger social issue than just a forensic issue. I don't think that forensic science really has a dog in that particular fight.
Jim Doyle, do you agree?
Well, I think I do agree. What you find in the wrongful conviction cases is that the leading cause is not the forensic science cases. It's eyewitness identification cases. In those cases, it certainly does appear as though cross-racial identifications are more difficult for people to make accurately. But even in the forensic science cases, when you have a wrongful conviction, it took more than a forensic science mistake. It's really a system error. It's more like a plane crash or the Chernobyl thing, where lots of things had to go wrong. There could be an error in the forensic science. It could be because the science is bad. It could be because the science practitioner is bad. It could be because the lawyers in the courtroom are bad. And the wrongful conviction cases generally have very complicated causes, more than one cause, and they have to coalesce. Now, many of those things are related, if you looked at it statistically, to race. Poor people are often minority people. Poor minority people often get bad lawyers at trial. The system sometimes seems to tolerate a much higher margin of error when it comes to poor minority defendants. but it's not really a forensic science issue per se. It's a system issue. It's a system failure, a kind of organizational accident.
A lot of different factors. John is on the line now from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. This is the one on the air.
I think we're going to have to let you go. I think your line is bad. Thanks for the call anyway. Dave is up next from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Dave. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on this very informative program.
Thank you.
I have a two-part question.
Okay.
One is, of all the various shows on TV, like CSI, you know, Miami, New York, NCIS, but the forensics they show, how much of the technology that they use is actually real, and how much is Hollywood? And also, of the technology that we see on TV that is actual reality, how can we bring that together in to a cohesive unit across the nation where the various labs can share information without, you know, trying to have one-upmanship or you know, dominance over the other, over the other because of the size or capabilities of their lab.
Budgets. Yeah, Dave, it's a great question. James Doyle, I'll let you take the first part of it. How much of these reality, how much is real in these shows, CSI and others?
Well, let me beg off that question because I don't watch the shows and I don't know much science. And Barry will be better probably on both of those things.
Okay.
But I think I can make one point about that, which is that there's a tendency to think now about this forensic science area as one of technique and technology and something that you can solve with a new technology. In fact, it's science, it's physics, it's chemistry, it's all sorts of difficult things, and we have to reach into the educational system and train forensic scientists. That's something that the committee is pushing hard for in this document, and it's something that the committee, I think, expects that the new National Institute for Forensic Science will continue to push. But it's very dangerous to think that if we just had the gadget that they had on CSI last week, we'd have the answer. What we have to have is a group of people who think scientifically about this process while the investigation goes on.
Barry, I only have about a minute left before this break. The first part of the caller's question we'll tackle first. How much of these high-tech gadgets are actually in labs across this country?
Many of them are. The only thing that's not really the case is the amount of time it takes to do the work. You can't solve a case in less than an hour.
And what about bringing the labs together, the other part of the caller's question, sharing information, trying to make this a more cohesive process?
I think the public would be surprised about the degree forensic science is networked in the United States. I'm at a conference right now in Denver, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. We have about 3,500 people from all sorts of disciplines from not only the United States but around the world discussing many of the issues that we're talking about right now. So there is a lot of knowledge out there. The big question, the big problem that we have is to move this thing forward, we are just a small part of a much larger criminal justice system.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing forensics, American crime labs, and the new report out just yesterday from the National Academy of Sciences. Lots of recommendations in there, including sweeping changes to the system from certification of forensics analysis to making crime labs independent of law enforcement. With me now from Denver is Barry Fisher. He's director of the Los Angeles County Crime Lab and author of the textbook Techniques of Crime Scene Investigation. Also with me this hour, James Doyle. He's a veteran litigator and now director of the Center for Modern Forensic Practice at John Jay College for Criminal Justice in New York City. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. From Denver, we're joined by Barry Scheck. He's a co-founder and co-director of the Innocence Project, an organization dedicated to exonerating wrongfully convicted people. He's a lawyer most known for serving on O.J. Simpson's defense team, where in 1995 he helped win an acquittal for Simpson's murder trial. Barry Scheck, nice to have you with us. Thanks for your time.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the Innocence Project.
Well, the Innocence Project really started in 1992. My partner Peter Neufeld and I'm a professor at Cardozo Law School. We began, we recognized the importance of forensic DNA analysis and were sort of in at the ground floor. And we began saying to inmates, well, you know, if you think you're innocent, you know, write us, and if there's any biological evidence in the case that can be tested to prove your innocence, we will make an effort to find it and get into court and vacate your conviction with new DNA evidence. And that was quite a long struggle because there was no state that had a post-conviction DNA statute, and now 44 do. Mm-hmm. And most of the evidence, very frequently the evidence was found to be lost or destroyed. But right now there are 232 post-conviction DNA exonerations that people can find on our website, innocenceproject.org, and over half of them have some unvalidated or improper forensic science involved in the conviction.
As a lawyer, has that surprised you, those numbers?
Oh, no, not at all. I think many of the things that Judge Edwards and Barry Fisher and Jim Doyle were talking about and are identified in this NAS report, which I hope is going to create sort of a seismic event in the forensic science community, how can I be surprised that shoe print evidence and ballistics evidence and microscopic hair analysis and all these different kinds of pattern evidence could be involved in a wrongful conviction when, as is clear and has been clear, I'm afraid, for a long time, there isn't adequate scientific validation of these forensic tests.
So what's your take on this National Academy of Sciences report? I mean, how do you think it will help going forward, change things?
Well, I think this is a critical turning point in the history of forensic science in America and perhaps the world, because this has to be taken seriously. You know, many in the forensic science community, which I think the report accurately characterizes as fragmented, you know, there are many, many in the community that understand the seriousness of the situation, like Barry Fisher. On the other hand, as Jim Doyle was warning in the last half hour, you know, I'm afraid of turf wars getting in the way of big, meaningful congressional legislation to implement these recommendations. It's absolutely essential that the federal government step in and put the kind of money forward in creating this National Institute of Forensic Science, an independent entity that can actually do the kind of basic and applied research we need to set standards for these forensic tests that, you know, are commonly used every day in courtrooms throughout the United States but don't have an adequate scientific basis.
The report made no judgment on whether past cases should be retried, but are you hopeful that that indeed will happen?
Well, I think this is one thing I hope doesn't get in the way of the recommendations in this report. Well, of course, lawyers all across the United States, we hope, are going to go into court now and say, look, this, you know, ballistics evidence, National Academy of Sciences that said it's not adequately validated scientifically. They're going to say same thing about impression evidence, tool mark evidence, bite marks, and courts really should hesitate, if not forbid, the admission of that evidence in the form that these forensic scientists are claiming they can make, you know, unique identifications. And hopefully, if that begins to happen on the front end, this will give more impetus to moving forward with this National Institute immediately, because it's desperately needed. So that's one thing. On the other hand, you know, slowly but surely, people will go back into courts in certain cases and try to upset their convictions. But I think the court system can handle it. There's been a lot of good examples. Recently, for example, the National Academy came down with a report about something called comparative bullet lead analysis. And this was a technique used by the FBI where they would say that some deformed bullet at a crime scene, its chemical constituents were similar to the box of ammunition that the defendant had, and therefore they could say that this bullet came from that box, or other kinds of claims like that. And Right. Essentially, it was found that it didn't. And now the FBI, in conjunction with the Innocence Project and some others, are systematically going back to those cases, which have been around since 1973, and sending out letters to judges and prosecutors saying the evidence is no good, so you have to review this particular case. And that process is working well. So I think the system can handle it.
Let me bring a caller into this conversation with you, Barry Scheck. Patrick is calling now from Boca Grande, Florida. Hi, Patrick. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing, Jane?
Fine, thank you. Go ahead.
I'm driving in my vehicle. I just wanted to make a comment that I think that crime labs and forensic laboratories should be separate entities altogether, and the law enforcement should have nothing to do with it, because, and I'm not alone in this thought, and when a law enforcement goes into forensic science, they're not conducting true science in the fact that they're going in with an outcome, a predetermined. They're looking for a guilty verdict, and that's not what science is about. Science is about going in objectively into a problem, and whatever the outcome is the outcome. And with that said, I think that they should be separate.
Let's ask Barry Sheck about that. Patrick, thanks so much for your call. Should labs be independent from law enforcement, Barry?
Absolutely, and this caller will be very pleased when he reads this NAS report, because that's exactly what they say. First, this National Institute for Forensic Science, certainly the research component has to be outside of the Department of Justice. It has to be an independent entity, in a science-based entity. That's first. Second, this report points out exactly what the caller said, and that is, as aid comes from the federal government to crime labs, they recommend that there be an incentive that the crime laboratory be independent of the police or prosecutors, because I'm sure Barry Fisher can tell you better than me, constantly across this country, when crime labs have their budgets dependent upon the police or the prosecution, particularly police departments, what will happen is they'll say, well, you know, what should we use this for? Should we use it for a mass spec machine or some really good piece of scientific equipment that can advance crime scene detection, or should we use it for a new police cruiser or hiring two more cops? Well, you know, that doesn't work. I mean, forensic science has to be an independent third force within the criminal justice system. It has to be science.
Barry Sheck, I know you have to go. I wish you would tell us very briefly, you've had such remarkable success at the Innocence Project, releasing people from jail, innocent people. Can you tell us one wrongful conviction that you've been able to overturn that's been particularly striking?
Oh, my gosh, I don't know where to begin.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been so many that, these are events that within a community, when there's an exoneration, it really is a total system failure, and it brings people back to looking at all the other problems within the system. We think this report is about the most important thing, that's happened as a result, in part, of all these exonerations, over the last 15 years. So, this is really a crucial moment. And I'm very encouraged, because I saw statements by Eric Holder yesterday, Jay Rockefeller, who's head of the Commerce Committee, Congressman Conyers, who's chair of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Leahy, who's chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. All of them, issued statements saying that they are very concerned. They're going to take this report very seriously. So I have real hopes that the administration and the Congress are going to move forward on this and move forward quickly.
Barry Sheck joining us from Denver, Colorado, co-founder and co-director of the Innocence Project, an organization dedicated to exonerating wrongfully convicted people through DNA. Barry Sheck, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jane.
What do you think, Jim Doyle? Do you think Congress is going to act on this report? Are you optimistic?
Well, it'll be a terrible missed opportunity if they do not. It's very difficult to see how they can avoid acting, but it's also a little worrisome that we could have turf wars in our future. Not about the substance of this, because I don't think they've left much room for anyone to disagree about the substance, but about which bureaucracy should be in charge. Traditionally, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been the place to go for science. The Bureau is a great capacity to resist things that it doesn't like to see happening. Whether they'll take that position or not, I don't know. I think for professionals in the criminal justice system, it's pretty easy to understand that everyone is better off if the forensic scientists are allowed to do science. And I think there may be a real tidal wave of opinion behind this.
Let's get another couple of calls in here. Lonnie is in Conway, South Carolina. Hi, Lonnie. Welcome, and thank you for waiting.
And thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
My question is, what protections does the public have against prosecutors and labs that collude, as in the Duke rape case, where they almost sent a number of young men to prison for a crime they did not commit?
Yeah, Lonnie, it's a good question. Barry Fisher, would you take it?
Well, I think the in that particular case, the court fell very strongly on the district attorney in that particular case. He lost his position. He lost his ability to practice law in the state. And he may have been also up for some other sanctions as well. So there certainly are mechanisms available if the occurrence is egregious enough. But it's there has to be a clear showing that that these things that these cases were involved some sort of conspiracy, collusion, or what have you.
Here's another call from Northborough, Massachusetts. Ginny is on the line. Hi, Ginny. Welcome.
My question was, I'm a junior in high school right now, and I was wondering if where I should concentrate my studies if I was looking into going into a career in forensic science.
What made you want to go into forensics, Ginny?
Well, I like the sciences, and I like kind of figuring out problems and stuff like that, and the TV shows look fun, but I know that's not realistic at all.
All right. Well, good luck to you. Jim Doyle, there's someone affected by CSI or some of the others, but what would you say to her? Where should she concentrate her studies?
Well, she should get a good general science background. I don't think the background you would want to be a forensic scientist is all that different from a pre-med kind of background. You would want to know real science. You'd want to know chemistry, biology, statistics. You'd want to know something about all kinds of things. And don't treat it like you're auditioning for CSI. Treat it like maybe you'll go to medical school or maybe you'll study forensic science.
Barry Fisher, I'm curious how the technology might change. So when Ginny's at the point where she might be entering the profession, may we see a different face to forensics?
It's a moving target. We're dealing with an evolving, continually changing scientific base. There are new technologies that are being brought to bear all the time. So, you know, what she needs to do is to get into a strong scientific background, academic program. Most people that go to work in crime labs either have a degree in chemistry or biology or forensic science in some instances. And the job market is pretty tight right now because of all these TV shows. A lot of kids want to get into it. So we're advising people to think in terms of master's degrees and even PhDs.
Hmm. Another call from Groton, Massachusetts. Matt is on the line. Hi, Matt. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering how this report might affect sentencing, particularly capital punishment cases, given that, you know, there are many people who are now exonerated by DNA evidence. Perhaps wondering if we should be more cautious with our sentencing.
Matt, thank you. Jim Doyle?
Well, it does introduce that question into the debate. One of the things, of course, that you have to remember about forensic science is that it's exonerated a lot of people, too. That even the forensic science, which is most questionable when it comes to identifying the person who did the crime, can be very helpful in terms of eliminating innocent people who may otherwise have been suspects. And so really the basic across-the-board infrastructure approach that the report takes is really the most promising way forward.
Mm. Barry Fisher, I'm curious. You're in Denver for an annual forensics convention. How have the people there been responding to the report's conclusions and what may follow from here?
I think most people are really optimistic. The leadership of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences is taking a very proactive role in this, along with the other organizations that make up the Consortium of Forensic Science Organizations. We prepared a press release before the report was due to come out, calling for a round table of all of the interested players out there. By interested players, I mean police organizations such as National Sheriffs, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, defense attorney groups, prosecutor groups, the ACLU, and so on and so forth, to the Innocence Project, of course, in an effort to get everybody to sit down and react to this and see if there is a points that we can agree on to try to move these issues forward. It's I think the heavy lifting now begins in terms of what the various stakeholder groups have to say, as well as Congress. And I want to put in a plug for a number of congressmen and senators that have been particularly helpful to us. Senator Shelby from Alabama has really pushed this particular legislation through and has really helped us out a great deal. And
well, there's so much more to come, and we're running out of time, but I know there are a lot more shows we'll be doing on this, I'm sure, in the future. Barry Fisher, director of the Los Angeles County Crime Lab, thank you for your time, sir. And Jim Doyle, the director of the Center for Modern Forensic Practice at John Jay College for Criminal Justice in New York. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Jay.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.